first rule of medicine is do no harm.
I'd encourage all 100 senators to participate because the American people need better care right now. And this legislation includes the necessary tools to provide it.
I don't have enough data in terms of the impact to my state.
I'm concerned that we're going to keep most of the Obamacare subsidies. That to me just doesn't sound like repeal.
I don't have the feedback from constituencies who will not have enough time to review the Senate bill. We should not be voting on this next week.
You'd like to have questions answered before you proceed.
Unless we act, we can expect things to get worse.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and call this hour The Philosophy of Healthcare and the Mystery Over All Those Numbers. The GOP Senate bill is now having to live in the world of real evaluation. The numbers seem to say this: 22 million people, $321 billion, all in a 10-year timeline. The Congressional Budget Office released its findings on the Senate's Better Care Reconciliation Act. That's the title. Monday afternoon, we got the numbers. They say that 22 million Americans would be without coverage by 2026. The $321 billion refers to the amount by which it would reduce the federal spending, the federal deficit, or the federal budget, however you want to put it, by 2026. Political reality will change all those numbers here if the GOP initiative actually survives the pushback from conservatives. Senators like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, for instance, claim the Senate bill doesn't go far enough to repeal Obamacare. And moderates are raising concerns about the number of potentially uninsured after this bill is passed. But Ovik Roy, conservative healthcare analyst, argues for people to quiet down and let what he says are market forces and a different set of incentives than Obamacare connect with consumers. He says that in the slow-moving business of getting people to respond to healthcare policy, getting them to buy expensive insurance and worrying about their legitimate fears, Mr. Roy, who is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, says this is a moment to pass something and just let it work.
I'd make the argument that for seven decades, effectively, the federal government has prohibited markets from working in the healthcare system. And that's not to say that we should go to some libertarian utopia in which there's no role for government at all. That's not what I'm saying. But that in very important ways, what federal policy has done, and Obamacare has made this a lot worse, is priced young and healthy people out of the market. So the reason why there's an individual mandate in Obamacare is because what the law does is it doubles or triples the cost of buying health insurance for young and healthy people. And so, of course, if you're going to charge a young person who goes to the doctor once a year and is perfectly healthy $300 a month for health insurance, when their average consumption of health care by a 20-year-old is about $700 a year, well, of course, they're going to look at that and say, you know what, that's a lot more money than I expect to spend on healthcare. So what you have to do is, through a combination of making the insurance market work for those individuals and a little bit more financial assistance, give them the incentive to join up in the pool. The mandate doesn't work. The mandate is not driving as much coverage as the CBO thinks it is. If you ask insurance companies, they'll tell you. The CBO says that of the 11 million people who are signed up on the Obamacare exchanges, 6 or 7 million of them are only signing up because of the mandate. No insurer believes that that's the case. It's more like maybe 10 to 15% of enrollees are signing up for the mandate. The vast majority are signing up because they want health insurance. And so there are ways to make the market work better for younger and healthier people who also want insurance, and while still protecting the vulnerable and the poor and the sick.
Although conservative and liberal observers of this have described the entire debate on healthcare as a huge social experiment to figure out what, in fact, young people will do. I mean, and in fact, you could say they may do this or they may do that, but in fact, we have some empirical data. The mandate is effective only so far. The GOP even recognizes that you need something more than market incentives to compel young people. I mean, there are amendments in the GOP bill that try to penalize the young people towards actually thinking about health insurance. I think you're right. If everybody thought in a progressive, preventive way about having health insurance, we'd be in a much different world. But that's not the world that we live in. And the CBO is right. The initial response to this GOP bill is going to be a huge retraction back to a lot of people uninsured. And the federal government is going to pick up the cost of that.
Well, if the Senate passes this bill, obviously we'll be able to have this conversation, John, in 5 years and see who's right. But I followed this stuff pretty closely for a while, and that's my view. My view is that the CBO is getting it wrong, and that in 5 years, it's much more likely that more people will have health insurance than do today because of this bill.
And I think that's, you know, it would be great if that was the way we could do things in the United States. But in fact, I mean, there are people with disabilities who are worried about the Medicaid expansion, you know, elimination and changes in the open-ended.
Because the Medicaid expansion doesn't affect people with disabilities. People with disabilities are already eligible for Medicaid and Medicare
But there are caps.
This bill doesn't affect them.
There are suddenly caps on Medicaid. There are suddenly state options to withdraw coverage for certain disabilities. And
I'm glad you brought that up, John, because the so-called cap on Medicaid, which, by the way, is an idea that came from Bill Clinton in 1995, the measure of inflation that the Republican bill ties Medicaid funding to is 1% above medical inflation, which is much higher than the per enrollee growth in Medicaid spending on the disabled. So this bill will not cut spending on the disabled at all. And that's just one of the ways in which the coverage of this bill has been faulty.
All right. So you mean coverage? So people with disabilities
coverage,
who are afraid
the
of
media coverage of this bill.
All right,
has been
but
faulty.
people who have been on Medicaid for 15 years don't read the paper to figure out what's happening next. They talk to their Medicaid worker. They talk to people who are affiliated with their healthcare provider. They don't watch CNN
sure, and how,
to
how
find
do those
out.
People get their information? They read that, the paper, right? So the information is getting to them somehow. And all I'm saying is that while it's understandable that people have fears because there's been a lot of fear spread through the way we collect information, they don't have anything to fear in substance because this bill does not do anything to take away their coverage or their options.
All right. So if the CBO is correct, how long do you think it would take for the incentives that you believe are in the Senate bill to bring us back to a situation where we have universal coverage or close to what the Obamacare numbers were? And the principle here in your white paper is universal coverage. How quickly will we get to that under this bill or something like it?
Well, the way the bill works is it takes about 3 years for the transition to take place from current law to the new system that the bill contemplates, because you need to give insurers in particular time to write the insurance plans that would reflect the new rules that this bill would install. So the thrust or meat of the bill really gets going in 2020 and 2021. And starting in those years, you'd start to see the transition to this new system of tax credits, and it's particularly the transition from those who get coverage through the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act into this new system where they buy their own health private insurance through the tax credit system, the same way that people on the Obamacare exchanges do today.
So if I've just been diagnosed with breast cancer or lung cancer, I'm fine for the next 2 years, and then I really do have to worry about the costs, my own pocket costs.
Well, you'd have your premiums would be covered, and depending on your situation, this bill does not cover the deductibles for people who are – it doesn't subsidize the deductibles to the same degree that the Affordable Care Act does. It does have about $100 billion in state innovation grants that states can use to fund deductibles. I have an op-ed in the New York Times today where I say that that's the most important thing in the bill to improve, that the Senate should contemplate increasing the amount of assistance that it provides low-income folks to afford their deductibles.
Right.
That's probably the main thing to improve about the bill.
We've been talking for a good period of time here, and finally we get to the issue of you're right that under this bill, in 2020 or 2022, people who are diagnosed with chronic conditions or fatal conditions like cancer are going to have a huge sticker price to pay for their coverage, and that's just something that the Republican bill says, well, we'll just have to work it out. And it not only is it legitimate for people to be terrified,
I mean, Right, so let's this is how fear gets spread when you make blanket statements like that. So let's be very precise. What the Affordable Care Act does is the Affordable Care Act provides cost-sharing subsidies for people to buy to pay for their deductibles if their income is below 250% of the federal poverty level. Above that level, it contains no assistance for people to fund their deductibles. And for a lot of those individuals whose incomes are, say, $28,000, $30,000 a year, their deductibles have skyrocketed under this bill. So they have breast cancer, and they're paying a lot more
right.
for their premiums and a lot more out of pocket under Obamacare and than they did before. So that's a problem that this bill addresses. And there also are, as I said, funds to cover deductibles, but that's an area for improvement. So that's one thing I think they should, before they pass this bill, if they do, revisit, in my view.
But what we come down to is the argument for people who are afraid of precisely these sticker shock issues is this bill can be improved. That's your argument. This is an improvable
absolutely.
Bill. That's what you got for them.
When Obamacare was passed, I think there were plenty of intellectually honest advocates of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 who believed that that bill was not perfect and could be improved. For example, a common criticism from the center left of Obamacare was that it didn't do enough, or some people would argue anything, to reduce the underlying cost of healthcare in this country. And that was a big concern of a lot of people who signed on. There were a lot of people who also on the left who didn't like Obamacare because, of course, it wasn't single payer. It used subsidies, tax credits for private insurance. And there were some people on the left who were hostile to that. But there's always things about any piece of healthcare legislation, particularly because of the politics of it, that are going to be imperfect. In my view, there are two things that I would improve, you know, in particular about this bill. One is what we've just talked about. And the other is I believe that we need to reform the way employer-sponsored health insurance works so that people there can have lower cost health care as well. So, look, this bill doesn't do everything I would want it to do, but does it do important things to make the broader system and the system for lower income people better? I believe it does.
Ovik Roy is a conservative health analyst and president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Ovik, thanks so much.
John, it was a pleasure.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.